You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Novelist Jonathan Lethem has never been constrained by literary boundaries. His first three novels were in the realm of speculative fiction and science fiction until he broke through with an offbeat detective story with a protagonist with Tourette's. Motherless Brooklyn won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Fiction in 1999. Since then, he's written a best-selling coming-of-age novel in 1970s Brooklyn, The Fortress of Solitude, won a MacArthur Genius Grant, The Chronic City, A Story of Manhattan Culture, another bestseller, and his most recent, A Gambler's Anatomy, about a backgammon hustler who thinks he's psychic. He's also written extensively on his cultural loves. He's been a perceptive cultural critic, from writing about the music of Bob Dylan, the film Star Wars, which he saw over 20 times in its first theatrical release, or the works of science fiction writer Philip K. Dick. Many of those essays appeared in his collection, The Ecstasy of Influence. His latest book looks at writers and writing that has had an influence on him, More Alive and Less Lonely, features essays, forewords, reviews, and introductions of writers he loves to read. Philip K. Dick, of course, Thomas Berger and Kazuo Ishiguro, to Salman Rushdie or graphic novelist Chester Brown. It's a fascinating look at his love of writing and love of reading. Jonathan Lethem is my guest today. Jonathan Lethem, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me back.
This new collection, I guess in a way it follows on The Ecstasy of Influence that you wrote several years ago about the writers and the books and the writing that just excited you. Except, well, most of these pieces have been, you know, sometimes they're front pieces for introductions to new editions of books or book reviews. What was the inspiration for putting out More Alive and Less Lonely?
Well, the first thing I should say, and it's really a defining feature of this book, is that it was edited and organized by another writer, by a young novelist, a brilliant young novelist named Christopher Boucher, who took this unruly pile of writings, most of them introductions to books or reviews of books, and a few other kinds of essays about writers and reminiscences about knowing writers personally, and shot them through with electricity and made them get up and walk and take on the form of a book, which I probably wouldn't have had the courage to do myself. After organizing The Ecstasy of Influence, that mammoth compendium, I didn't know what to do with all of the remaining stuff, and it was Chris who saw how there could be a sort of a tidier, more targeted collection that would follow it. And it, so that one's about everything. That one's about rock and roll and
right.
comic books and politics and, growing up in Brooklyn. This one's about books and writers. It's really much more structured that way.
Now I'm going to ask a dumb question, but maybe there's a smart question at the heart of it is, how much time does a working writer, and how important to a working writer, is it to be reading other people's material?
Oh, well, I think it's a great question. I'll start with kind of origin stories. As a teacher of creative writing, one of the things I find myself saying all the time is, reading is how you get from here to there. It's pretty much the case that anyone who's going to write fiction, stories or novels, has got to have spent somewhere at least a decade, probably more than a decade, as a completely obsessed, voracious reader of fiction, because you don't imprint on how to make language do that work, how to make narratives out of sentences, unless you just take a tremendous amount of it on board. I really believe that that's the way writers become writers. And some, and you do hear this, some tail off and read much less after they begin writing themselves. I think it's inevitable that, you tail off somewhat, and I have. But for me, a constant replenishment, a constant roving curiosity to, sample new stories by other people, new novels by other people, has felt really essential. I just think it is part of my job, and it's also an immensely pleasurable part of my job to be taking stuff in as well as pumping it out.
How do you balance that, though? Because you're teaching, you're writing, you're turning out a novel every 3 to 4 years. You're doing a lot of writing besides that for essays or introductions or all sorts of things. How do you balance your reading life with your writing life? I would think it would get difficult the older you get.
It does get difficult, and making sure you have really good glasses helps. There were some years where I was finding reading harder, and then I realized actually it was my eyesight, which it was actually harder work.
You need bifocals.
You need the right glasses. And you need to have a room with a door that shuts your kids out from time to time. But, of course, it's challenging. And, you know, I mean, I say this without it presuming to, you know, have any ethical implication, because it's not an ethical decision, but you watch a lot less television. I mean, I'm just never up to speed on the new things that people are talking about. Instead, I'm immersed in this, you know, kind of voyage across a sea that has always just entranced me of, you know, finding books that surprised and energized me, and I give a lot of myself to it. I can't read the way I used to. I mean, as a teenager and in my 20s, I was in a fever. I would put away, you know, 4 or 5 books a week, really, because I would do nothing else, and I didn't have any money for anything else anyway. And there was no one who needed me to pack them a lunchbox in the morning. So it's changed, but the desire hasn't gone away, and so I steal time. I find it.
I think it would be very interesting to watch you maybe pick up books at a used bookstore, one from your own writing, because you're always trying to, you've heard this many times, you're a genre bender, but you tend to write, the next novel is going to be different from the last, and it's going to be in a completely different genre for the most part.
Well, yeah, I guess, of course, that comes out of my reading promiscuously. I just love a lot of different kinds of things, and it always felt to me that the kinds of writers that I was most particularly impressed with or identified with were the ones who tried new things and varied within their works. So I knew I would want to try a lot of different stuff. And it really is as simple as this restless, curious sensation that, you know, there's something else waiting for me that, you know, I haven't tried. But yeah, and so I still read it in an extremely various way. I mean, there are times when I go on a binge or a bender with one particular genre or a particular writer, you know, leads me down a certain avenue, or I'll reread something that I've read before. But usually I'm on that search for the thing that is least anticipated, the most surprising thing I can find.
Hmm. Well, perhaps the most surprising essay in this collection is one of the first essays, and it's what you refer to, The Loneliest Book. And I suppose that, you know, any serious reader probably has that one book that they probably think, you know, I'm the only person that loves this book this way.
Yeah.
In your case, it was The Happy Valley by Eric Byrne, who people might recognize that name, but it's for an entirely different reason. Tell us who Eric Byrne was.
Yeah, it's such a strange story. So Eric Byrne was a popular psychologist who wrote a famous book in its day, and the title became lastingly famous, Games People Play. And he was one of these guys, you know, an early instance of one of these guys who took some knowledge out of, you know, a social science field and had an enormous popular success with a book that projected that knowledge into, you know, a kind of a popular realm. You know, I mean, I think of someone like Malcolm Gladwell.
Right.
And Games People Play was a sensation when it was published, and it was about, you know, interpersonal dynamics, I guess. I've never really read it. I have a copy somewhere.
There was one in my parents' house. Yeah. I remember seeing the Games People Played, and I think when I was a kid, I opened it up thinking, oh, this could be games, and of
right.
course it was like, oh, throw that away.
Yeah, but there were several pop songs written with that title,
right,
because it's such a great title. And that was how people knew Eric Byrne, and he probably had a few follow-ups to that. But in the flush of his popular success, at that point where a writer could publish anything they want to do, he did what a lot of people do when they're famous. They write a children's book. I mean, Madonna wrote one. And, you know, sometimes a sports figure will write a children's book. It's sort of the thing you do if you want to have written a book. So Eric Byrne wrote a kid's book in a very sort of psychedelic mid-60s hippy-dippy style. I mean, it was like an Alice in Wonderland type of project, or Phantom Tollbooth, but even more paisley-colored. And it was called The Happy Valley, which is a very innocuous, dull title. I mean, for someone who'd made up such a memorable title with Games People Play, but Happy Valley was anything but innocuous and dull. It was a really crazy, overloaded, kind of ingenious, but also out of control, helter-skelter kind of kid's book. And it was also beautifully illustrated by this enigmatic French illustrator who I've never seen illustrate anything else, and so it just had a singular quality. And I don't know why it was handed to me, maybe just because I was running out of conventional children's books to read. I was such a hungry reader. And I latched onto it and memorized sections of it. And, you know, it really, at the time I wrote that essay, I was asked to supply this, you know, notion of what, you know, what's the loneliest book you've ever read. I still had never met anyone else who even knew it existed, let alone had taken it to heart. And, you know, I wrote the essay about it, and I wouldn't say that, like, the Happy Valley fans have come crawling out of the woodwork subsequently. It's still a pretty lonely, I'm still a fan club of one, as far as I know.
Although you did get a letter from the illustrator.
The illustrator became a part of my life, and that was a really delightful, you know, one of those absolutely unpredictable stories. She saw her name on a Google search in this essay and contacted me, and she's a French painter. Turns out she wasn't a book illustrator otherwise, really, at all. She's a serious painter, and actually, I'm in my office. I'm staring at the painting she gave me, a beautiful, eerie picture of a man in a rabbit suit levitating a woman over a pleasant green landscape.
The rabbit as a magician.
Yes, rabbit as magician, exactly. She is a really interesting presence, and I haven't spoken with her in a while, but I visited her studio in Paris. And so this is the kind of weird voyage that being the lonely fan of the Happy Valley can take you on.
Yeah. Now, earlier we were talking about how you've tried to move around and where you set your books and how the actual genre you're writing in. I mean, you started out writing in speculative and science fiction, and then all of a sudden Motherless Brooklyn came out, which was a very different detective story, but an inventive detective story. And there's a large section about three writers in particular, Kazuo Ishiguro, Philip Dick, and Thomas Berger. And, of course, Berger was also like that. He was always writing a different book.
Yeah, he's almost the ultimate model for someone who, you know, insisted over the decades that he was going to, you know, make a visit to every genre. I mean, there are detective stories, and there are allegorical fantasies, and there are beautiful, tender coming-of-age stories about his childhood in Cincinnati, and there are absurdist contemporary novels, and there are war novels. And he just wouldn't stop experimenting with what kind of framework he could put his voice into, and yet it's such a singular voice. I mean, you read a page of Thomas Berger, you never mistake it for anyone else. So as much as he tried to diversify, he also had this stylistic clarity and distinctiveness that just made him a genre unto himself.
Now, people know probably know him as much for the movies made from his books. One very good, one really, really bad.
Right.
And Little Big Band, of course, with Dustin Hoffman, was really a fairly faithful retelling of the novel.
It's a very solid film, very watchable and enjoyable film, although I can tell you that Tom didn't think it was, he didn't dislike it, but he didn't think it was a representation of what he'd done in the book.
No, well, and it probably isn't. I mean, it's a film, and there's so much more detail in Little Big Man.
Yeah. Well, I also think he was struck correctly by the time that film was made in the 70s. It had become an allegory of the Vietnam War for the filmmakers. Mm-hmm. You know, in the counterculture, that was such a defining crisis, and that film was made by people like Dustin Hoffman and the director, I'm blocking his name, the guy who also did Bonnie and Clyde. And they were explicitly referencing the Vietnam War in the way they depicted the Battle of Little Bighorn. You know, the American failure was being referenced. But Berger had written that novel in the, you know, he'd been researching it in the late 50s and early 60s, and he'd had nothing like that in mind. So that, to him, set it in a very different framework. But, yeah, and then, of course, they made this sort of abysmal John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd movie called Neighbors from one of his finest books, one of his funniest books, and one you could almost imagine going back to and trying again to, you know, try to film it again.
Right. That movie actually kept me from reading Neighbors for a long time. And when I finally did, it was like, oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I could see it standing in the way.
Yeah.
I was lucky I'd read the book before that came out.
Well, you know, there's countless others. Another one I really enjoyed was Robert Cruz, which was sort of a modern-day retelling of Robinson Crusoe.
That's right. It was his Desert Island book. I mean, you can even hear just in this, you know, so here we have the suburban, dark suburban comedy in Neighbors. He writes a Desert Island book, an epic Western. You know, he really was the ultimate restless writer that way.
And he was, you were obviously a big fan of him, and you actually got to know him, at least through letters.
I did and I didn't. It was a very uncanny friendship. For decades, we wrote letters, and we never met, and I think he sort of resisted meeting in person. He was a reclusive soul. By the time I was in a position to journey to him and offer to come to his house, he was in, you know, a late-life retreat from human company. He and his wife had sort of batten themselves into their house, and they weren't receiving visitors. So we stayed pen pals, and you know, I then had the strange fate of being pulled into his estate, because there were no family members really. He had no children. He and his wife lived a long time, and they were very alone in the last part of their lives. And there was sort of no one to clean up afterwards. So I ended up taking some of his library, and I ended up being the one who scattered Tom's ashes in the Hudson River, which was his request, and I was sort of the person who was there to do it.
Yeah, you got to see his library, and you said that was just a fascinating look in his mind.
Well, you know, any writer's book collection, if it's made available to you, will be a kind of journey into their universe, and Tom's was all beautifully organized and alphabetized, and there were lots of autographed copies of things from writers, you know, who 40 or 50 years earlier had sent him a copy of their book, and he kept it, and, you know, and there was also evidence of his research. You know, one of the things I took, he wrote among his voyages, he wrote an Arthurian novel, you know, story of King Arthur and his knights. Tom did a retelling of it called Arthur Rex, glorious book, and I found Tom's copy of La Morte d'Arthur, ancient, battered, beautiful, old English language translation of La Morte d'Arthur, and I thought, well, here it is. This is like the lodestone. This is the book he excavated a whole novel out of.
My guest today is Jonathan Leatham, a novelist and writer. His latest book is actually a collection of his writings on books and writers titled More Alive and Less Lonely, and it's published by Melville House, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, it's interesting in that section where you have several essays on Thomas Berger and several essays on Kazuo Ishiguro and Philip Dick. There's a disclaimer in the middle of that section where it's a couple of your early criticism efforts that are included in the book, and you kind of have to do a disclaimer. Why did you want to disclaim how you wrote about Ishiguro and Berger early?
Well, you know, if you start gathering up stuff you've written for 3 decades, you're going to find some embarrassments or have some reservations, and there's 2 ways you can deal with that. One is to suppress the writing in question, and, you know, I did. There's stuff I just thought was lame and limp, and I pushed it aside, and Chris agreed with me, and we didn't glance twice at it. But sometimes you find interesting stuff that makes you kind of arch an eyebrow and say, well, you know, there's something happening here, but you know, what a pretentious young man I was, or you know, or why did I think that? And in a couple of cases, I found it interesting. I guess I did this in The Ecstasy of Influence once or twice as well, to go ahead and republish a piece that I don't completely feel in sync with anymore, and then say something about that, because I think that itself generates an interesting situation. And so with Ishiguro, it was the case. I mean, I'd written I'd gone on a kind of a critical foray where I thought I saw something in one of his books. It was a novel called When We Were Orphans, a very interesting, very tricky book that he'd written. And I wrote a very tricky review saying that I thought that he'd been, you know, thinking such and such, and one of the things I thought he did was make a reference to Batman in it. I thought there was a elaborate, you know, kind of side joke about Gotham City and Batman and Commissioner Gordon and so forth. And so I wrote this into the review, and then I had a chance to meet Ishiguro, lovely, lovely man, and I was chatting with him about this, and he seemed like the kind of person you could ask about something you'd said in a review. And I sort of aired out my theory, and he said, yes, I read that, and it was very interesting, but no, I didn't have that in mind in any way, and Batman doesn't mean anything to me, and so it was just kind of a puzzle to me. He didn't seem upset about it, but it made my piece, in retrospect, look quite like a pratfall. And so I just thought, well, you know, this is what we do when we read, and so it's sort of interesting, is we project ourselves into the you know, if I'd been writing that book, I probably would have been thinking about Batman. But he hadn't been. So it was me, you know, and that's what reviews consist of. They're this occasion for two minds to meet up, and if you don't read a book and have all sorts of your own thoughts and fantasies and projections about it, you're probably not really reading it at all.
Yeah. And of course, Ish is another one of those writers who, you know, the first three books sort of were an interesting progression to The Remains of the Day. And then all of a sudden, it's like, okay, I'm done with that. I'm going to do something completely different. And, it, you know, in many ways, it's like his audience was totally confounded because they had come to expect a certain Ishiguro novel, and all of a sudden he's doing all sorts of different stuff. Again, yeah. This is probably something that attracts your interest.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm amazed by his bravery to write some of the different things he's done. And for me, that's where the action is. I mean, I think The Unconsoled is one of the great novels by a living human. I've read it three times, and it's a piece of permanent marvel to me that it exists. So I will follow him anywhere, and experiments don't all have to work. If they take the writer into an exciting new space that produces results, that's a much, much better way to proceed than to just, shore up your strengths and huddle inside an established routine and just write the same book over and over again.
Well, since you mentioned Batman, I have to mention the essay where you write about how Batman is your superhero.
Yeah, he was the first figure of, I guess, fear and desire for me in that realm. And I've certainly gotten interested in others over the years, but I think if I examine, kind of my that mysterious place where your inspiration and your, nature and nurture meet, I think, it was falling in love with Batman when I was 4 or 5 years old that made the emblem of the superhero compelling to me, with all its, embarrassments and contradictions.
What is it about Batman? Because all of these superheroes have been retooled, every couple generations, but Batman is constantly being reinvented.
Yeah, well, there's his vulnerability. First of all, he doesn't really come to the party with any genuine superpower, and there's also the strange way he's both deep and shallow. When he puts on his costume, he seems to be a emblem of pain and revenge and sorrow, and then when he takes it off and he returns to his so-called real life, he's just this callow millionaire.
I believe you referred to it as like a classic one percenter.
yep. He does not really an attractive presence. And so, maybe that's a sort of image of the artist who's deeper in their work than they are in their ordinary walking around self.
What do you think of all the retoolings and reinventions of Batman? Do you think it's just because he's such an interesting character?
Well, yeah. I mean, and also a very, in some way, a very incomplete one. A figure like that, it's almost like Batman is more interesting than anyone has managed to make him. And so there's this constant effort to substantiate, what would you call it? He's iconographic, and the icon of Batman carries a lot of possible meaning. The stories around him are often really kind of dumb and unsatisfying. So it's like we're throwing storytelling at this emblem and trying to make it come to life.
My guest today is Jonathan Lethem. His new collection of essays on books and writers is titled More Alive and Less Lonely, and it's published by Melville House, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Before we leave, I want to ask about the essay To Catch a Beat, because we get a little sense of you. Well, they get a little sense of you in all these essays, but maybe the younger you when you were, formulating your literary universe, because you were working at this used bookstore in Brooklyn, the Clinton Street Books. Tell us a little bit about working there. How did that influence you? And also this incredible beat figure you met.
Yeah. Well, I was fortunate enough as a book lover and a reader, but also sort of into the books as objects, as a collector. As a teenager, that world in New York was still really legible. You know, maybe it might have been on its last legs in some way, that there could be lots and lots of little dusty used bookstores with these dedicated bookmen keeping them going in a major city like New York. You know, now real estate and the internet, you know, one on one side, one on the other, has pretty much driven that realm out of existence. But there were lots of them, and they carried a lot of history and meaning. You know, you could walk in, and no one was particularly friendly, but they would let you just dwell there and, you know, eavesdrop at the conversations at the counter and, you know, live in the stacks and read a lot and then buy, you know, a token item or two. And I did that as a teenager, you know, and then I took the next step, which was probably in some ways a pretty generic one at a certain time and place, you know, that was passing from existence, which was I said, hey, do you need some help around here? And I tried to apprentice myself to all these different old, you know, grumpy book dudes. And I did a couple of times. I succeeded. And so I was probably 16 when I was working at Clinton Street Books, which was a real hole in the wall. Like almost every one of those bookstores, within a couple of years of my working there, it was replaced by a laundromat. Seems to be that was the formula. There was a customer who was particularly fugitive presence who, I mean, he wasn't really a customer because he wasn't buying anything. In fact, he was trying to sell books to us to make money for a cup of coffee or whatever it was he wanted that day. And he was Herbert Hunke, who was a legend in the beat world. He was a poet, but he was also very well known as the guy who had first given, you know, William S. Burroughs heroin, and he was kind of, you know, the pet drug dealer for a while to the famous Beats. And he was still just, you know, kind of skulking around New York City doing things, and in this case, sometimes doing, you know, borderline illegal activities. I think he had a pile of copies of books that Allen Ginsberg had autographed to him, you know, to Herbert from Allen with Love, which was in principle, a very important Beat Generation Association copy. You know, it's autographed by Ginsberg to Hunky. That seems very important, but when you have a giant stack of them, they're not worth a whole lot.
That's right.
You got to find a buyer.
I think Ginsberg did it just to help him make money,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
And eventually it became apparent that we weren't selling any copies of this, and the fact that Hunky was just coming and shoplifting his own book off our shelves and pretending it had sold so he could resell it to us. So I was put on Hunky Patrol by the guy who ran the shop. I had to watch him like a hawk every time. So I was like, you know, I was like a policeman. I was just trailing Herbert Hunky around, making sure he didn't, you know, slip books into his overcoat pockets.
Hence the title, To Catch a Beat. Good title.
Thanks.
Well, it's a great collection, and it's a pleasure to speak with you again. Jonathan Lethem, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Novelist Jonathan Lethem is my guest, the New York Times bestselling author of 10 novels. His latest book is a collection of his essays on writers and writing he loves, More Alive and Less Lonely. It's published by Melville House. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.